This edition of the week is sponsored by Invitrogen. Gibco Cell Culture products now feature easy-to-read, color-coded, and writable labels that are easy to find. Take a closer look at www.invitrogen.com/labels.
Hi, I'm Carrie Grenz, and welcome to The Week, the weekly news podcast from The Scientist. This week, we all know or have met self-professed sugar addicts and chocoholics, and we certainly know people who overeat to unhealthy degrees. But could the reason for unhealthy appetites be that food is addictive? Last week, I attended the Keystone Conference on the Neurobiology of Addiction, and as you can imagine, all the usual suspects were discussed, like cocaine, opiates, nicotine, and alcohol. But it was a surprise to find that food addiction was also talked about a lot.
No one has really considered food as a problem. It's never been a problem. It's something we need to eat, we need to grow and develop and need to put on weight as we're going from young to older, but hopefully not after that. But now people are realizing that food has its problems.
That's Sarah Leibowitz from the Rockefeller University. Later, you'll hear her evidence for why food might belong in the list of addictive substances. But first, senior editor Brendan Marr has a look at some of the news stories that have appeared on our website, thescientist.com, this week.
Melissa Lee Phillips reports on new data that contradict a prominent theory on aging. Scientists have believed that mutations in mitochondria somehow drive the aging process, but a group from the University of Washington found that while these mutations might be correlated with aging, they are not causative. The group found that mice with rates of mitochondrial mutations 500 times higher than normal did not show signs of premature aging. Nevertheless, one of the study's authors, Lawrence Loeb, says that he and his colleagues only looked at point mutations in mitochondria. There is still the possibility that large deletions could affect aging. Also in the Scientist Daily News, Graciela Flores writes about a gene that codes for social behavior in honeybees. Vitellogenin, which is involved in egg laying, has been shown to also influence the onset of foraging behavior and prime bees for specialized foraging tasks. The investigators at Arizona State University used RNAi to knock down the vitellogenin gene. The bees shifted from nest tasks to foraging tasks earlier in life, and they showed a preference for nectar. The paper marks the first time that RNAi has been used to manipulate the behavior of bees in the field rather than in the laboratory.
You can read the full articles from the Scientist Daily News on our website, thescientist.com. Next up, can you be addicted to food? At a recent conference on the neurobiology of addiction, I sat down with Sarah Leibowitz to discuss her theories that food could behave like a drug. Leibowitz studies feeding neurochemistry at the Rockefeller University, and here are some excerpts of what she told me about her latest studies on food being addictive.
The bottom line to our work is really we think exists a vicious cycle between the fat that we eat and the effect that the fat has on the brain. And then the brain is responding in such a way that it makes us want to eat more fat. So this is what we call a positive feedback. We also call it a vicious cycle. And I think we've all experienced this in terms of having some fat, very often mixed with salt, like potato chips that we can't stop eating, and nuts and things of that sort. And what we have found is just that the fat does activate certain proteins in the brain, small proteins which we call peptides, and we know in our animal research, by administering these proteins to the brain, that it makes the animals want to go eat a high-fat diet, more than a high-carbohydrate diet. Although they like both, they will go to the high-fat diet. So we have one arm of this vicious cycle. So you administer these peptides, it makes them go eat more of that fat-rich diet. Then when we give them a fat-rich meal, that fat-rich meal then makes the brain produce even more of that peptide. So that is the vicious cycle that we're going to be discussing and giving more information on that we've discovered over the past 6 months.
It's interesting. We can also say, you know, what those peptides are, and if we could talk a bit more about what their significance is.
The peptides that we study are called enkephalin and dynorphin, and these are opiate peptides, and they're made by the brain. And we do know that they do stimulate appetite, and we do know that they can produce feelings of addiction. They can be addictive-like. So these are opiate peptides, but they're also non-opiate peptides that also stimulate appetite for fat. And two of these are called galanin and another called orexin. And these two peptides are not opiates, and they don't necessarily cause any addictive type behavior, but they are peptides that make us want to eat more. So what we feel is there's sort of a relationship between non-opiate peptides that make us want to eat more and opiate peptides that add more of the craving and perhaps addiction to that eating behavior. And it's possible that as we start learning about foods when we're younger and we start eating them, and we realize initially that they're kind of nice and they taste good, but if we keep doing that several weeks and keep growing on that, then they actually, it's more than just, wow, that's kind of nice, I like it, I like the flavor. It's more, wow, I gotta have that sort of thing. I gotta have more of that. And we sort of a seeking behavior for that very palatable, good-tasting food. What may happen initially in that development process is we work with non-opiate peptides that just make us enjoy the food, and it's good and we like it when we eat it. But the opiates come in to add more of the addictive or craving quality of that pleasure. So we, I think, have both a non-opiate and an opiate peptide circuit.
And you're talking there about experience and being exposed to these foods over some period of time that would sort of reinforce that feedback loop. What about any other sort of susceptibility, genetic, for example? Have you studied that at all?
Well, there are genetic influences on our eating behavior. We really do not have any good handle on that to say, okay, this specific gene is causing us to like fat or another one, sugar. It just doesn't work that way. We don't have that information available. There's been years of study to try to understand alcohol, what makes us want to crave alcohol, and there are models for that, but that's had a lot more research than in terms of our appetite for fat and sugar. I think what's most important here is the environment. But it's this vicious cycle that when you're in the midst of that environmental influence that'll lead you to want to eat more of that particular food. Genetically, as I say, we don't know. What's, again, also most important is our very young children or even during pregnancy. This is a key problem, is that when we are exposing our very young brains, either in utero or after birth, to these foods, the brain will respond and possibly have some long-term consequence to that. That is a real problem. And that, I think, is contributing to our childhood obesity now with these very fat-rich and sugar-rich foods.
Do you see, after being exposed to these fat-rich diets, that the levels of these peptides are elevated long-term, even after that diet might go away?
Well, that's a very good question, and we really don't have a good answer to that right now. I do feel, though, that in principle, that as we're exposed to these diets, that the effects will be more long-term. The question is, are they permanent, or do they last a few days and go away? And we haven't done these time course studies, but that's certainly a very important question. And then what I alluded to a few moments ago, I feel that the younger we are when exposed to these diets, then the more long-term the effects will be.
This morning we heard some talks about addiction and the influences on dendritic spine growth or synaptic plasticity. Do we know what overexpression or elevated expression of these peptides might do in terms of those kind of structural changes in the brain?
Again, that's a very good question. That's precisely what we're working on right now. No, we don't. We know so much about drugs that's been studied for the past 40 or 50 years and some more on alcohol, but no one has really considered food as a problem. it's never been a problem. It's something we need to eat, we need to grow and develop and need to put on weight as we're going from young to older, but hopefully not after that. But food is a natural substance and we need to eat it. But now people are realizing that food has its problems. And yes, I do believe the food is going to affect the structure of the brain. And that's what we're investigating.
It seems to me, I mean, you think about this loop, it seems obvious to me that some sort of evolutionary sense, it's really helpful for an animal to crave high fat, maybe in a, you know, an environment where there isn't much.
Yeah, there are mechanisms for gorging in nature. I mean, you know the pictures of the bears stripping their salmon and they just throw in the skin because that's where all the fat is. And they throw away the meat, the protein. And, you know, all the gorgings that you see going on, the lions, the fact that they have to stuff themselves till they're almost in a stupor because that's the way it is because food is not readily available. Gorging is a natural process. And so that's, I think that this is certainly a takeoff from that. Now, I would like to underscore in the work that we're doing that what we focused a lot on in earlier years in our research are the hormones in our body, whether it be hormones from adipose tissue or the pancreas, insulin, or whether it's steroid hormones from the adrenal glands or the female steroids. These are all very important, but what has been greatly neglected are the nutrients themselves. So whether it's a sugar-rich diet, which produces more glucose in our blood, or whether it's a fat-rich diet, produces more triglycerides, the lipids in our blood, this is what has not been investigated, and this is also what we're focusing our studies on, to say it's the nutrients themselves that are really the problem. We can even inject or infuse a lipid, not have it go through the mouth at all, but just put it directly into the body, and these lipids will then go into the brain to affect the expression of these various proteins and their synthesis in the brain. So we don't even have to go through the digestion process. It's the nutrients in the blood that are causing these problems in the brain. And we feel that these lipids are interfering with our normal satiety. We can't feel these negative feedback, this turn-off satiety signal that's coming in. These lipids are interfering with that signal.
That's amazing.
What we find is that we overeat fat relative to carbohydrate. It's just the meals are always larger when you have a lot of fat in it. And what we find is that not only do we eat a larger meal, that if we control that meal size for a high fat versus a high carbohydrate meal, we control that meal size and then we go an hour or two later, we are actually hungrier after that high fat meal than we after the high carbohydrate meal. So it has its lingering effects, long-term effects, such that the fat cannot turn off satiety, and so that an hour or two later after that, you'd think you'd be full and so heavy with this fat meal. That's not the case. We're actually hungrier, so we eat more after that fat-rich meal. So what we're trying to understand is between what we call a preload of that high fat or high carbohydrate, just a small meal, it's like a bite to eat, and then we wait an hour. What we're trying to track is what's occurring in that hour before we then overeat in the next hour, because then we can get more the causal effects of this fat sort of preload on why we eat more later on. And what we find is these opiate peptides are overexpressed, and they are what we are feeling are causing us to be hungry later on.
With that high-fat preload.
Just a small high-fat preload, just 15 calories. It's a small one. And we get hungrier after that than we did do an equal calorie, 15-calorie low-fat preload. Same palatability, same caloric density. Everything is the same with these two preloads. But we are hungrier after the high-fat preload. And so we're trying to understand the intervening mechanisms here as to why we are hungrier at the end. I don't know if you have cats, and I have experienced it myself, where you give them little treats, and initially they sort of stick their nose up in it. And, it's okay, all right. But after a few weeks of that, boy,
yes.
They go for it.
Yes.
They go for it. And that's the craving that we're hearing about today relative to drugs. It will not be as strong obviously, as with drugs, craving for foods. You can't expect that. And whether you call it addiction or not, it's just a question. People question whether there is a, quote, food addiction. But there are definitely food cravings. We know that's for sure. And so it takes time to develop those food cravings.
Well, I guess a last question for you. I know we brought up a number of questions that you're going to be investigating, but what for you is kind of the big looming one that you really want to discover in, say, the next decade?
Well, if I could just digress and answer the question here, what I will end my talk on tomorrow, and we've published on that, and there's been some press on it, but in terms of the one alcohol, I would just say that really, it's been about 2 or 3 years of work on this in collaboration with Bart's lab, is that the alcohol really seems to show the very same traits as the fat. And what I mean by that is the same peptides that make us want to eat a fat-rich diet can stimulate our drinking of alcohol, and that when we give animals an alcohol diet, or when they're drinking more alcohol, they stimulate the same peptides that are responding to fat. So we have the same them in the same vicious cycle that fat is, alcohol is also. And what we feel is important, the common links there are the lipids in the blood. Alcohol drinking will raise our triglycerides in our blood. These triglycerides will stimulate the same peptides, as I say, that respond to the fat. And that what also happens is that we find that when, and we have a published study on this, again, in collaboration with Bart, is that if we eat a fat-rich meal, it'll want to have us drink more alcohol compared to a low-fat meal. So you can imagine yourself at a dinner table having a glass of wine and a fat-rich meal. You take a bite, and then you take a drink, and a bite, and a drink, and a bite, and drink. They're going back and forth, and we feel that the lipids in the blood are working together to activate these peptides in the brain to want us drink more alcohol as well as eat more fat. So they're working together in synergy to really exacerbate the problem. Now, alcoholics, people who considered alcoholics do not get fat because they're undernourished and they don't eat the right diets, and alcohol does stimulate certain metabolic processes. But it does, as I say, this fat in the diet is making them drink more alcohol.
Amazing.
So now, to answer your question about what we want to discover, what we're working on now is we've set up a large number of animal models, and that's really the hardest thing. I think you can see from the presentations today that the animal model, what you're really studying, is very critical, because you change a little of this, do a little of that. It's different. So what is it we really are trying to understand here? And we know the eating behavior and drinking of alcohol, these are very complex processes. And you're not going to have any one protein, one hormone, one nutrient involved here. So what we've tried to do is broaden to look at a wide range of peptides. And we're also looking in outside the hypothalamus at the base of the brain. We're trying to understand other brain areas that are involved that have to do more with the psychological components of ingestive behavior, eating behavior, the emotional components, the cognitive components. We need to get a broader idea together, really, to understand how these particular peptides and others are working together as a network to tell us that we want to overeat fat or sugar. And I think we're now applying to these animal models various gene screening techniques that allow us to really understand more generally what's happening in the brain, which is going to be very complex. But we feel we now have the tools available to make these important discoveries.
That was the Rockefeller University's Sarah Leibowitz talking there about her studies into food addiction. Go to our website to read the features, blogs, and web extras from the March issue. You can also read the latest from our Culture Friday series. In this week's article, find out what it takes to be a scientific advisor for movies and television. You can also lend us your thoughts, read the editor's blogs, and keep up to date with the Scientist Daily News. That's all from the Scientist Podcast this week. Thanks for tuning in.
This edition of The Week was brought to you by Invitrogen. Gibco cell culture products now feature easy-to-read, color-coded, and writable labels that are easy to find. Take a closer look at www.invitrogen.com/labels.